Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Christian Axbo Nielsen. I am Associate Professor of History and Human Security at Aarhus University in Denmark. My guest today for this episode of the New Books Network is Dr. Jesse Barton Hroneshova, who is a Marie Sklodowska Curie Global Fellow at UNC in Chapel Hill and Kafoskari University. Her new project is investigating how frames of victimhood have featured in the politics of post-socialist Europe in the past two decades, and whether and how such frames have influenced the current liberal trends across the region. Jesse was previously ESRC postdoctoral fellow at the Oxford Department of International Development, where her research focused on post-war dealing with the past in East and Southeast Europe. She has authored and edited several studies on identity politics and retributive transitional justice. And Jesse has also worked for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, for the OSCE, and for the Balkan Investigative Reporting Network in both Sarajevo and Belgrade. Today, we're going to be discussing Jesse's new book, The Struggle of Redress, Victim Capital in Bosnia and Herzegovina, published in 2020 by Palgrave Macmillan. This fascinating book explores the different ways in which groups of victims and survivors of the 1992-1995 Bosnian War seek redress. These include families of missing persons, victims of torture, survivors of sexual violence, and victims suffering physical disabilities and harm. In her book, Jesse traces the history of redress making for each of these groups and shows how differently they've been treated not only by the Bosnian authorities at all levels, but also in some cases in their interaction with the international community. In Bosnia and Herzegovina since the war, thousands of victims have had to suffer often re-traumatizing ordeals in order to secure any kind of recognition or redress for the suffering they endured during the war and afterwards. While some have been legally recognized and have been offered some forms of compensation, others have been recognized only recently and only in a geographically or ethnically limited way. So I look forward to talking to Jesse about this. Jesse, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being my guest. And I want to start out with the question that I was thinking about most of all when I started reading your book. What motivated you to write about this precise topic?
This research was quite a long in making. And as you said, I worked in the region and I also worked for the ICTY in The Hague. And so the issues of transitional justice have always been of great interest to me. And so originally when I embarked on this project, this was part of my doctoral research. And my doctoral research when I embarked on it was completely different. I was mainly interested in Europeanization of transitional justice in Bosnia and the external influences on it. And then as I went into the field and as I started talking to people that have been working in the field of transitional justice and human rights in Bosnia, but also in the wider region of the former Yugoslavia, I realized that we have not really been looking at what levels of reparations, compensation, or what I then ended up calling redress have been secured for war victims. And it has seemed to me, initially, I had this hunch that a lot of the efforts that have been offer any type of reparations to victims in Bosnia in particular hadn't been done in an extremely piecemeal manner, and no one was initially able to explain to me who actually got what or who secured what. And it was such a complex picture that I decided, well, this is certainly worth researching, because not even the utmost experts on this topic actually fully understood who's entitled to what and why.
And in dealing with this subject and then approaching it, were there any past works or authors who particularly inspired you to work on this?
Absolutely. So I'm a huge fan of Elisa Helm's work and her study on victims in particular, and on female victims of the war were a huge inspiration to me, as well as the works of Laura Nettlefield and anthropologist Sarah Wagner. So there has been a growing body of research that I was able to draw on, and those were probably my main inspirations.
And those are all excellent works, of course. Your book uses several terms that might not be readily familiar to a non-expert audience. Perhaps you could start by discussing the key term victim redress, and perhaps also victim capital, and how you define them.
Yeah, sure. So I had to come up with, as I said, this was a bit of an uncharted field. And it seemed to me that the terms that we have been using in transitional justice were extremely imprecise, or a lot of the times too broad to actually capture what I was actually researching, what I was finding. And so I had to start looking at what I then in the end started calling victim redress, which, as you might see if you read the book, I defined as both in-kind and material financial benefits that individual victim groups secure and ultimately receive if the administration works. But I also, despite the fact that this seems quite material and you know, quite physical, I also understand redress as having this implied direct recognition of the status of a victim. And I'm sure we will talk about what status actually means within the Bosnian context, but victim redress therefore not only implies the material benefits, but it also contains this more symbolical status grant, if you like. So this is how I define the term victim redress. Now, victim capital is the other side of the story, and this is where I look at the agency of victims. And this concept also crystallized throughout this research, and it essentially captures the leverage and agency that victims have through what I called international salience, their mobilization resources, and moral authority within their communities.
Now, that's already quite a lot of complexity we see embedded there, and we're going to further complicate this with the term victim itself, which, as you point out in your introduction, is not even a universally accepted term and is in fact contested by some, and there's alternative terms. So could you perhaps elaborate on why the very word victim is so disputed?
Yeah, so I think especially in gender studies and feminist scholarship, there has been a very rich and wide-ranging debate about the usage of the term victims and survivors, and especially from the perspective of these individuals that have went through these horrific experiences. And the main point of these, or issue around these discussions is about agency and what agency the terms actually imply and what levels of power and empowerment both of these terms apply. So the preferred term that is often being used, especially regarding survivors of sexual violence, is survivors rather than victims, mainly because that then implies a certain level of agency, that someone has emerged from this experience more empowered and in charge of one's fate. And so usually what one sees in the current debate regarding gender-based violence is that the preferred usage of of the term is survivors. And I think in the Western world in particular, we generally do talk about survivors rather than victims. Now, the problem with a country like Bosnia, and I'm sure a lot of other contexts, is that quite a lot of those survivors across the board, not only of sexual violence, actually do consider themselves as victims. They even use the term victims in the names of their organizations. So the main organization for individuals who went through sexual violence is actually called Žene žrtve rata, which is women victims of war rather than survivors of war. It's also because the word survivor is a little bit clunky in the local languages, so that might be also why. But I think what also emerged throughout my research was that the term victim is a lot of the times being used in the courtroom, and it's more of a legalistic term that bears with it potentially more empathy from internationals, from legal experts, and so on. Survivors is more used in the NGO sector and among activists, if you like. And so, in the end, I follow the widespread usage of the term žrtva, victim, across Bosnia, even though I do say as well that in some individual cases, some of those people that I spoke to consider themselves to be survivors. I also want to say that there is a hidden tension within, obviously, my coinage of the use of victim capital, because victim, as I said, would imply lack of agency, whereas capital, as I argue throughout the book, does the opposite. It implies quite a lot of agency. And so I think this also quite captures what I was trying to say within the book, is that though victims / survivors have quite a lot of power over their redress, which is what I denote with the term capital, and this is what most of the book is about, the term victim then implies that there are quite serious limits to these powers, and those are some of the structural conditions of the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think also what I enjoy in the book is how you also explore some of the historical roots of the term victim and how it has been used in the past also in a socialist Yugoslav context. So we'll get back to that a bit later. But moving on to the groups that you identify in your introductory chapter, you identify five distinct groups of victims. Can you briefly present these groups and tell us how you arrived at this typology or categorization?
Yeah, so that was a really tricky part of this project, because anyone who's been studying Bosnia in particular would have come across this general feeling that everyone who survived the war in one way or another is a victim. Anyone who went through the siege of Sarajevo is a victim. Anyone who lived in eastern Bosnia and was internally displaced is in one way or another a victim. What I was interested in and what I ended up looking at were mainly policies for people that suffered such harms that are completely irreversible, i.e., you can't pay them for a new house, you can't return them to their places of origin, and they suffered such harms that are incomparable to some of the other suffering that most of the population that back then lived in Bosnia would have gone through. And I was mainly interested in those policies, the way that they were adopted at the entity and at the state level. And throughout my field work, I was working with I was interviewing quite a lot of NGOs and civil society organizations. And through them, I got access to the various victim associations. And basically, through my work with these victim associations, I was able to identify five key victim groups that have self-organized in Bosnia after the war and jointly been asking for both justice and truth, as the key demands, if you like, but also increasingly more for something that I call redress, which is this compensation. And so these groups are missing persons families, victims of torture, the so-called civilian war victims, which is the severely disabled, but also families of those that were killed, victims of sexual violence or survivors of sexual violence, as we discussed, and also what I call military victims. Now, I think the most the group that I had to justify the most within these five, and why I included it, included it were military victims. These are in Bosnia called Ratni Vojni Invalidi. They're not just veterans, they're not just ex-combatants, but they're those that are severely disabled and were severely disabled during the war. And I had to include them so that the analysis actually makes sense and so that the research design makes sense, both conceptually as well as analytically, because within the victimhood regime in Bosnia, they have often mobilized themselves with or against the other groups. And within the social system as it exists in Bosnia, they have been linked to civilian victims of war in particular. So had I left them out, the story of redress and how these various groups have been asking for redress would have had a gaping hole in the analysis. And so this is why they were included. And they also, a lot of the times, do talk about themselves as victims of the war.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that also fascinates me about the book is the way in which these different groups not only define themselves, but also jostle for position with respect to each other and other actors in society, including non-victim groups. So maybe moving on from that, how do victim groups in post-war Bosnia actually organize and mobilize and seek the recognition that they want? And what are some of the typical challenges they face in doing so?
Yeah, so the first step, obviously, during the war and right after the war, was to create formal organizations, the so-called victim associations. There are hundreds of them across Bosnia. Some are place-specific, others are linked to these various sources of victimization, which is what I was focusing on, basically the source of the harm, if you like, and the nature of the harm. So once they've organized themselves, the second step is to, and that's usually linked to each other, is to formulate a set of demands. Initially, the set of demands was depending on which type of a group. So among missing people, the first key demand was information. Where are our loved ones? Where are our family members? In other cases, it was retribution. Victims of survivors of sexual violence were quite adamant in this respect. And, you know, there is a combination of all of these demands in every single one of these groups. But I think, as I said already, as time went by, really one of these demands that strongly crystallized across these groups has been a certain level of recognition and redress. Because I think initially a lot of these groups just expected something to come with time, and for most of them, not that much has actually arrived. So the third step, once you know they've formulated demands and organized themselves, is obviously to come up with various strategies how to push these demands through. And again, depending on the various groups, they would have used campaigns, direct lobbying. With a lot of them, they already had a direct access to important policymakers or journalists, and they were able to draw on various resources, be it organizational resources, but also financial resources. And clearly, a very important link that a lot of them have established was with the international community or international actors that have been active in the country. And then this is where the interesting thing happens, how these demands through these strategies resonate with whom, why, and what happens. And these are some of the challenges. So some of the demands simply have not fit within the wider international or political frames of justice and accountability at the right time, and are simply dismissed or discarded. So, for example, calls for, special protection of disabled persons was really no one's top priority in the early 2000s. Instead, sexual violence has really been extremely important as an international topic, as a global topic, if you like, within the framework of human rights. And so were disappearances of civilians and combatants, after all, as well. And so some of the challenges are linked to timing as well as the priorities of the main actors and those who wield power over policymaking. And I think the second challenge that until now most of these groups are facing is the endless set of administrative and bureaucratic issues that Bosnia has, the set of legal issues that Bosnia has. And I think in one way or another, this book is also a micro study about how the dysfunctional administrative structure of Bosnia has affected those that have needed the state or the various authorities to protect them the most. And so even as I demonstrate in the book, even once some of these policies were adopted, that did not necessarily directly translate into people being able to draw on these and to be able to get these benefits. And until now, a lot of them are still fighting for a simple legal implementation, for an implementation of a law that was adopted and that they fought really hard to be adopted. And so I think that is the main challenge. And I think it has had a huge emotional and psychological cost for a lot of these individuals.
Mm-hmm. And now at this point, both you and also I have alluded several times to the quote unquote international community or international actors. So could you perhaps say a few words about which international actors are relevant in the context of your study?
Yeah, so obviously the first one would be the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. I think not so much directly initially, but indirectly because the ICTY was simply framing partially the identities of these victims, so that Srebrenica families have become survivors of genocide, if you like, because of the rulings at the ICTY and so on and so on. And it is quite interesting to observe that until now, most of the victim groups you talk to are very much aware of which cases are relevant to them and which cases they can, so to speak, leverage when talking to any human rights organization. You know, they would say, oh, you know, but in the case of Krstić, we have evidence that this has happened and I was there, so I'm basically directly one of the victims. So in this way, the ICTY has, I think, been important, despite the fact that it has also led to quite a lot of disappointment regarding some of the judgments. Then you obviously had a series of humanitarian organizations, and it could be it ranges from the International Red Cross to some of the more religiously linked organizations, if you like, that were providing the direct humanitarian aid right after the war, and quite a lot of them then in one way or another remained or started supporting local NGO organizations, and until now the indirect influence of some of these organizations can be seen in, you know, the capacity building for some of the NGOs that are working on these issues. I think Tuzla has become a big hub of some of these organizations, in addition to Sarajevo, and we have some in Zenica as well. But I think the third actor or the group of actors, if you like, that I feel that we have somewhat underestimated or do not really seem to talk about that much is the International Commission for Missing People, the ICMP. I was quite struck by how positively the ICMP was evaluated across the country. I think it's always hard in Bosnia to find any agreement on anything. And obviously, I should say that I spent quite a lot of time in Republika Srpska as well, working with the Bosnian Serb victims, so I have heard their perspective as well. And even they were very positive, especially with the, they were very satisfied with the initial work of the ICMP, with the technological progress of the DNA analysis that they developed, and the support that the ICMP provided to the families of survivors, to the families of the victims and the families of the survivors. And they, across the board, really positively evaluated not only the actual work, which is finding those individuals that went missing, but also just including those families in their work, in, you know, any meetings that they had, and making them feel like part of the process. And really, to me, that was quite eye-opening, because that was in a stark contrast to the work of the ICTY. Obviously, one could argue that the work of the ICTY is completely different in its nature to the work of the ICMP. The ICMP simply needed those families. They needed their blood samples, you know, they needed their information. They directly needed to work with them. But in the same way that ICTY needed witnesses, you know, and it seems that really there, there was a different approach. The ICMP has also been mainly staffed with with local Bosnians. So there was a different type of rapport, I think, as well. So the ICMP, I think, was extremely critical and should not be forgotten. And obviously, we have some other institutions, such as the High Representative. Now we have some of the EU institutions that, you know, are very interested in human rights issues and do support victims, sometimes only, you know, through declarations and so on, sometimes through direct project funding. But it really is a range of institutions. It's a range of various donors and funders, as well as multinational and multilateral organizations.
Well, I think your point about the ICMP versus the ICTY is particularly interesting because, as you point out, both of them needed and used, and I mean that in not necessarily, of course, a negative sense of the word, both of them needed and used victims, and yet we get these, as you say, quite different perceptions of them. And certainly the ICTY faced a lot of criticism for, among other things, not sufficiently reaching out to victims and making them feel part of the process. So it's very interesting to hear your reflections on that topic, particularly as you are familiar with both organizations or institutions. Moving on to a later chapter in your book, you have what is, I have to say, one of the most interesting chapter titles I've seen in recent memory. Your fourth chapter commences with a quote, "Why is my leg worth less?" Tell us about this quote and how it allows you to frame your analysis of victim status between civilians, victims of the war on the one hand, and combatant victims on the other.
Yeah, so the context of this this quote is that this emerged from an interview with a very young and very smart, I must say, Bosnian woman in Mostar, who was unlucky enough to be at the wrong time, wrong place during the war. And as a little girl, she got hit by a shrapnel, and as a result of which she has remained disabled. And so she's educated. She managed to get a degree in law and subsequently became quite a prominent voice, at least locally, for civilian war victims in Bosnia, and especially with regards to this redress that we've been talking about. And the reason for that was, as she explained, that she really acutely needed the various legal privileges that the victim status would have given her, so that she can get better medical care, or actually any free medical care, so that she can make the needed adjustments to her home, and so that she can be able to study in the way that she needed to, and in a way live normally, if you like, whatever we imagine of the word normally. But her problem was that initially, despite the fact that there was actually a law that she would be entitled to receive something because she was in Mostar, and again, going back to the structures of Bosnia, that law was not being implemented. So first her and her colleagues had to fight for the law to be implemented. Then in the end happened in the early 2000s. And then afterwards, she realized that the amount of money she was getting was extremely small, and the various privileges that the law was actually granting her were also quite limited. And so she started wondering why. And then she realized that according to the law, civilian war victims are entitled to get only 70% of what the military victims get. And this is what I was saying in the beginning, how intrinsically related these categories and these groups are. So, and of course, there is this combatants premium, if you like. So for the very same injury, if there was such a thing, a former soldier would simply receive not only more money, but also a much wider range of services and benefits regarding healthcare. And, you know, a lot of the discussion was turning and twisting around what type of crutches one could get, and what type of prosthetic legs one can get, and what type of wheelchairs one can get, which ones are the best ones, and so on and so on. And that really mattered for the quality of their life. And so this is where, you know, she basically said this, why, I still don't understand, why is my leg worth less? And I think, you know, this also explains the very complex situation when, you know, the state would, or the entity in this case, would compensate a person with the very same injury in a completely different fashion, mainly because of this combatant's premium. And it's, on the one hand, it's understandable. There has, ever since Theda Scotsbold's work, you know, there has been this understanding that there simply is a combatant's premium. But on the other hand, in a war like this, which has really targeted, not targeted, but where civilians have suffered quite dramatically, it is extremely difficult to understand. And so this is where this comes from.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Indeed, and of course, embedded in this, as you've suggested implicitly as well, and also drawing a line to the work of authors like Elisa Helms, whom you mentioned at the outset, there is inexorably a gender dimension as well, because of what we know about the gender composition of combatants versus non-combatants. So that layers into your analysis and the overall, I think, frustration and tensions. Yes. Here as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, moving to a different set of identities, one that we probably, I think, end up talking perhaps too much about. But to what extent did you observe any contact or interaction between victims groups, or indeed categories of victim groups or associations of different ethnicities, Bosniak victim groups with Croat victim groups, Croat victim groups with Serb victim groups, etc.?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And yeah, I could talk endlessly about this because this was really fascinating. It's a mixed bag. Some of them try to cooperate and some of them are on pretty good terms. I think the civilian war victims, mainly because they have been one of those very forgotten groups, if you like. They have been trying to work together because they simply understood that they don't have any other choice because no one really pays any attention to them otherwise. The civilian war victims of Republika Srpska, they have a union, and this union also exists in Sarajevo for the Federation. And they have been trying to work together. And so the Croat civilian victims would belong to the entity union, if you like, that has its seat in Sarajevo. They have been trying to work together, and, you know, with their limited resources, they've tried, not very successfully. That's not as interesting as the other ones, because in the other ones, politics really kicks in, and it does get quite frustrating. I think the most politicized, if you like, group, unfortunately, are the victims of torture, the so-called logorashi, so people that would have been tortured during the war in various camps across the country. So you have unions in Republika Srpska, and then you have a counterpart union in the Federation. However, the Federation actually had two unions, one for Croats, one for Bosniaks. It's quite a complicated story. And here it's a very convoluted political story that in a way mirrors what has been happening at high level politics in Bosnia in terms of how they have been cooperating with each other or not, or falling out with each other. I think the interesting one, or the one that has been trying to balance it out, was the Croat leader of the union, who unfortunately died about a year ago. And I think he was the only one who was always trying to bring them together. In Republika Srpska, the leader has been basically, as someone finally told me, a leader appointed for life. He actually was in the end changed about last year, I think, that there's a new leader. But he was the leader of this organization for 20-odd years. In the Federation, they have been changing, and depending on which political party, was it the Social Democrats or was it the Party of Democratic Action? Depending on that, they were either collaborating or were not collaborating. Extremely convoluted story, so they have not really achieved much together. I think mainly because from the leadership, there really was not that much of a willingness to do so. But also because they have been extremely corrupt. And I mean the leadership, I don't mean the individual members. Mm-hmm. So the last Federation leader, I think, ended up in prison for opening a genocide museum in Sarajevo. And, you know, basically very unpleasant story about what has been happening amongst them. I think there's some work by Cécile Joanneau, who has also been looking at, you know, the more local level politicization of some of these associations as well, that I strongly recommend reading. Now, the other ones have, again, differed. With the missing persons, the whole story, and I know we will talk about this, has been mainly dominated by the Srebrenica genocide. And so despite the fact that there has been cooperation, and as I said, the ICMP has been actually the one trying to bring these organizations together all the time, there has always been this inherent tension that it's the Srebrenica associations that dominate. So, and now you also have some missing persons associations in Republika Srpska that simply do not recognize the genocide in Srebrenica, hence they will not cooperate with these associations. And victims of sexual violence, survivors of sexual violence, despite the fact that there is an organization in Republika Srpska, it was clearly set up only for Serb women. It was a huge controversy in 2013. Again, they do not really cooperate with the one in Sarajevo. So I think the ones that collaborate the most, or used to collaborate the most, funnily enough, are the military victims and are the invalids, who would do various sports events together. And, you know, they would do things here and there together. But really, to talk about a sustained cooperation or collaboration, there really hasn't been much of that.
Mm. It's interesting you mentioned this with the veterans organizations, because on a purely anecdotal level, and with nothing approaching your level of field research, my own observations have been that I've had occasion in Bosnia to remark on the, in my opinion, kind of surprising affinity that I observed on several occasions in different fora among veterans organizations, where a lot of the male veterans seemed in a way kind of relaxed around each other, and also because they exchanged, for example, stories about being quote-unquote ordinary soldiers who at a very young age were forced, as they saw it, by historical circumstances to enter into armed conflict. And that's kind of, I think, in a way served to remove the burden, both for themselves, but also they recognize that in their counterparts of responsibility for the negative things that were associated with their roles.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, since you mentioned the genocide in Srebrenica in 1995, You have an entire chapter, chapter 5, where you discuss what you call the Srebrenica effect. So could you further explain and elaborate that?
Yeah, so a bit of context. So the only state-level law that was ever adopted in Bosnia was in 2004 for missing persons, for the families of missing persons. And now this law was quite revolutionary, if you like, in the way that it was adopted. It was through the participation of all these associations that we were talking about for missing persons. And it was spearheaded by the ACMP. It led to the opening of a state-level institution. It led to probably some of the best statistical data that we have about this population, who, where, what. It also led to the adoption of a victim compensation law. Now, the victim compensation law has never really been implemented, so that is not such a positive story. The other parts of the law have, in one way or another, been implemented. Now, why I call this Srebrenica effect was that, the ICMP was set up. It didn't exist before 1996, and the ICMP was set up mainly because of Srebrenica. The shame of Srebrenica has really led to quite a lot of heartbreaking changes within the international community. I dislike the term international community, but I still keep using it because it's a shortcut for the various external international actors. And so the ICMP was set up in a way to help, to help the local population to find the missing and to find their bodies and to bury them, to help them with the financial costs of the burials and the findings and so on and so on. And because of that, a series of other things have happened, some of them being the setups of these various associations, the opening of various memorial centers, the biggest one obviously being the one in Potočari next to Srebrenica. Obviously, ultimately, it was also then the adoption of the 2004 missing persons law. And so the shame of Srebrenica, the implication of the international actors, the Dutch battalion and the UN in this war crime, in this genocide, and the fact that no one really stopped it, has in a way led ultimately to a much more careful approach and to much more attention that was being given to this issue that ultimately led to this law.
Mm-hmm. And moving beyond also just the laws and the categories that we've already been operating on to a particular category of violence that I think has to date often been neglected, but which I think you and other recent authors have really done a great job of bringing to the forefront, namely the category of sexual violence committed incidentally also against victims of both genders in Bosnia and Herzegovina. What specific modalities of victim status and redress does your book address with respect to such victims?
Yeah, so victims of sexual violence are now essentially written into the law for civilian war victims as of 2006 within the Federation. And as of 2018, they are able to get some benefits also as part of the so-called torture law that was adopted in Republika Srpska. So that is what the law says. Now, the problem with this category, if you like, is that sexual violence is a very specific war crime. It's a very emotional, it's a very private matter, especially in countries where basically being violated in this way is considered shameful. It bears a stigma. And so what I realized is that despite the fact that now there is a legal basis for these survivors to come out and basically claim some of their benefits, and they're not huge, but to get around 250, 300 euro a month in Bosnia is actually not negligible. It's not a negligible amount, and it does come with some benefits. But the number of individuals that have actually come out and gone through the process of certification, as they call it, to actually receive these benefits, is quite small. It's around 1,000, just over 1,000 individuals. There are some men included in this as well in the Federation. And despite the fact that some of the estimates from the war, ranging from 20 to 30, 40,000 of violated individuals, it's quite a small number. There are various reasons for that. Obviously, some of these individuals died, committed suicides, moved out, etc., etc. But still, it is a small number. And I think here, in the case of sexual violence, what comes out very, very strongly is how the process matters as much as the outcome. So achieving this status and the procedures that have been put in place for achieving this status are sometimes so traumatizing for the individuals that it's simply emotionally not worth it for them to go through this. And so I think often I face this question from people, you know, that don't really study these issues, like, why are they coming out now? You know, they should have been coming out 10, 20 years ago. And if you think about it, to be violated in such a way is something that most people really just want to forget about. And it takes a lot of time to, first of all, emotionally deal with it. Then a lot of people are also just waiting for their husbands or parents or someone to pass away so that their families just don't know about this because it's personally so shameful for them, or they're waiting for someone in their community, not to be present anymore so that they feel safe to say so. I think some of them have been still waiting for some of the perpetrators to simply be brought to the justice so that they can feel safe to come out and so on. So there are so many various reasons why this really hasn't worked in the way that it should have worked, despite the very brave work of organizations such as Medica Zenica, Viva Žene, Snaga Žene, and so on. It really has been quite a disheartening story. And I must say that, unfortunately, the very dominant victim association in the Federation, initially having an extremely positive impact on this story, I think increasingly, especially because of these quite traumatizing procedures, has also negatively impacted how this law is being implemented, because it has basically become a gatekeeper to whom the status can be given to, despite the fact that it doesn't have monopoly anymore over the procedures, but still it wields so much power over this issue that it has become extremely unhealthy.
Yeah, I mean, there you're really dealing with a lot of very controversial and sensitive issues. Not least the notion of victim groups who become gatekeepers, and the risk that instead of becoming facilitators for victims, they in a way become almost barriers to the redress process, or in ways institute various forms of hierarchies. And of course, one could mention the obvious point that re-traumatization and suppression of memory or reluctance to approach the authorities is a widespread phenomenon when we look at sexual violence in any country, much less, of course, a country that is as traumatized as Bosnia was after the war, and where there may also be additional cultural considerations that play in. And I think one of the things that I really respect about your work is the nuanced way in which you approach all of these interlocking factors. Speaking of challenging approaches, you mention in your book that your field research at times involved speaking with informants who had, let us say, very strong and, from your point of view, one could say problematic or very maybe extreme points of view regarding, for example, the events of the Bosnian War, and in particular major war criminals or specific atrocities committed during the war and how they perceived those. How did you, as a researcher in the field, navigate your interaction and conversations with such informants?
Yeah, so I think this is probably where I have grown the most as a researcher throughout the work. I think I have started very much with this mindset that, you know, we're going to have a discussion about this, and I'm going to lay out the facts, and we're going to talk about this, and they're going to see for what, you know, the facts are. And I think I tried this twice and realized how wrong that was of me to do so, because who was I to be lecturing, you know, my respondents on what their experiences and their views were? They live in Bosnia. I did live in Bosnia most of the time as well, but obviously I didn't have any of their experiences. And I think this is really where my entire methodological and ethical approach, I think, to doing fieldwork changed. So I don't think we have to necessarily step back and simply take quite a lot of the untruths that we are being told and accept them and simply accept them and write them in and then judge them in our own work and say, well, this is, you know, you can see how nationalist these people are because they don't even know that this was a genocide, et cetera, et cetera. I think what I try to do and what I'm increasingly trying to do is I keep calling this empathetic research or empathetic academic approach is to understand why this person holds these views and to try to give the context. And so let me just give you an example of probably the most, from my perspective, frustrating and I would say excruciating interviews I ever had to do. And I had to sit there for 3 hours or 3.5 hours. I think the interview lasted. And it really was probably the worst experience I had. But at the same time, it was the most telling for what I'm talking about. So this is basically a leader of the missing persons organization. He's a male in Republika Srpska. And his view of not only the most recent past of the Bosnian War and the Srebrenica genocide, but also the Second World War is completely distorted from, you know, any established historical view of what actually happened during the Second World War, what happened in Srebrenica and so on. And the number of conspiracy theories that he was able to enumerate throughout the interview was endless, from, you know, dead bodies being brought from Kosovo to Srebrenica, to Bosniaks shooting each other, to the Bosniak army shooting each other, etc., etc. It was endless. But the problem is that this man didn't fight. He was a civilian during the war, and he had one son. His son was a soldier for the army of Republika Srpska who went missing during the war. This man does not know what happened to him. His body was never found. And he is deeply traumatized by that. He's basically still grieving for his son in the same way that a mother in Srebrenica is grieving for hers, one could say. And so to him, to accept that his son was killed, went missing, and on top of that was killed in the name of an army or an idea or an ideology that committed a genocide is completely inconceivable, because it would suddenly make his son's death even more futile than it already probably is. So the nationalism and you know, the stories he was basically telling himself, and I actually think he really believed in them, to him it was emotional and psychological coping. So his defense of Republika Srpska, his defense of the denial of Srebrenica, was basically a deeply personal matter, and it was a coping mechanism. And I think, to me, that was a revelation to understand this doesn't excuse him. This doesn't excuse a person of, you know, a person who's traumatized as he is and who's grieving in the way that he is, obviously shouldn't be in this position and shouldn't be speaking on behalf of a group of people in the way that he is. But that is a separate issue. I think at a personal level, I felt it was really important for me to put this within a context and not to judge this person at face value for what he was telling me and for these fabrications and these fake stories that he was telling me, because deep down I really felt sorry for him. I really, losing a child is unimaginable. And it does not really matter if it's one son or seven sons, ultimately it's a child. And so I think this is where I have grown the most, because I always tried to, and I hope I succeeded, to put some of this context in why, you know, people actually do truly believe in these fabrications and why the denial is so pervasive in Republika Srpska. And the same actually applies to the other side as well, although I do think there is a bit more empathy from the other side. So, yeah, I think it's this lack of empathy obviously pains me from the Bosnian Serb side in particular, but from both sides, I'd say, really.
Well, I can definitely understand that. And I really appreciate how you can speak openly about how your views evolved. And I can only state that as someone who worked at the ICTY, I know that my own views on, for example, a defense counsel, the way in which perpetrators defended themselves, and the entire dynamic between defense and the prosecution also changed over time by really trying to relate to these people, not in a relativistic way, of course, but in a way of trying to understand why they were taking the positions that they did. Now, I'm going here towards the end to exercise my prerogative of what we in Bosnia would call profesionalna deformacija, and speak as a historian. So one thing that fascinated me in your book is that you talk a little bit about how terminology has evolved or been influenced as relates to victims by the legacy of the Yugoslav communist regime. In her own book on victims, and particularly also looking at the way in which the Holocaust is dealt with in the former Yugoslavia, our colleague Jelena Subotic argues that the Yugoslav communist regime was not particularly interested in victims after the Second World War, but instead preferred to commemorate resistance fighters and liberators, as they were called. This obviously links to the cult of the fighter that you mention in your book. So do you detect any long-term effect of this in the way victimhood was constructed in Bosnia and is constructed? And do you see any other connections between the Yugoslav past and even the Second World War in victim identities and processes of victim redress?
No, for sure. For sure, there is a clear link. And I think especially initially in the way things were set up. And, you know, this whole idea of this sacrosanct status that one needs to obtain as a victim actually comes from this Borački, from this combatant status that a lot of these partisans had after the Second World War. I think Heike Karge has also written some work on this in German, which is fascinating, but not that much other work, I think, has been done on this. But I think the resonance now is a lot lower to what it was initially. But as I say, the structures were initially set up. Basically, a lot of the laws were simply transposed from the former Yugoslavia. So, you know, the disparities we were talking about between civilian and military victims were simply taken over from the previous system. And so at the structural level, you definitely see these legacies. Some of them have changed incrementally over the time. Some of them have simply stayed in the way that they were. I think there also is some psychological, if you say, legacy. And I think that can be quite visible when you speak to some of the veterans, some of the former soldiers who really do have quite a lot of disdain towards civilians. I have heard them say things such as, you know, well, they were just at the wrong time, the wrong place, so why should they even receive anything? We were the ones, you know, who were putting, you know, our health and our life and everything up there on the line and knowingly doing so. So obviously we need to be the ones that have a higher status, if you like. So there is a hierarchy here as well. And I think that certainly is a legacy of the former Yugoslavia. But I don't think that's necessarily so specific to this region. I really do think I'm currently in the United States, and, you know, the obsession with veterans that there is here, wherever you go, it's the veterans that go first. It's be it boarding on a plane, be it, you know, any authority, they have a preference. There is this military premium that exists worldwide.
Right. And there we could, of course, have a very interesting discussion about militarization of societies and what that means, because the socialist Yugoslavia was throughout its existence also in many aspects a very heavily militarized society. And that, in many ways, already before the war started, one could argue, stacked the deck in favor of combatants over other kinds of victims. Now, for my last two questions, I'd first like you to maybe draw out, I mean, you've already given us a lot of insight into your research, but what major lesson or lessons, what is the kind of main takeaway you would like readers to draw from your book?
So I think at the policy level, which is where I really want to make some impact if I can, is how important it is to to actually include, but actively include, not just tokenistically include, but to include survivors in the policies that are being designed for them. Because there were so many flaws in these various laws and various loopholes that, you know, a legislator simply cannot even think about unless you have those individuals in the room and you understand what their grievances are and what their needs are. And so I'm just going to go back to the law for the missing persons, which on paper is a very good law, I think, because it does address quite a lot of the issues that those families have been dealing with. The problem is that it's not being implemented for various other reasons that have nothing to do with what is actually written in the actual law. And so I think quite a lot of the problems are actually part of the fact that in the other legislation, victims were simply excluded and there was really no meaningful participation from their side. And at the same time, there is also something of too much of participation or too much of visibility of victims in post-war societies, I think. And I think that is also partially because they have felt that they were not meaningfully included in some of the more important processes after the war, in the peace-building processes. And so they are finding other avenues and other ways how to be visible and how to be meaningful for Bosnia. And I think this is extremely sensitive to talk about it, but I think in various aspects and in some parts, you know, in pre-electoral campaigns and things like that, they really are suddenly advocating for causes that really are not theirs and have not much to do with their own causes. So I think it's this double-edged sword of too little on the one hand and too much on the other.
Mm-hmm. And my final question, which I hope you can run with, is if you were asked by your colleagues and in particular young up-and-coming researchers what related research questions you would like to see explored pursuant to your own book and your own research, what would you say?
So I think if we think about the region and Bosnia in particular, I think we still need to start studying the other side, so to speak. There's a lack of academic empathy towards the Bosnian Serb and Bosnian Croat side of the story. And I think once we know more about that, then we can put the pieces together. It's the whole scholarship on Bosnia has been extremely one-sided, especially on these issues regarding transitional justice. So I think that is, from my perspective, something that I would have loved to do. Work on veterans as well. We don't have much work on veterans. And I think that opens an avenue for a great comparative research project with, you know, Croatia and Bosnia and Serbia. And that leads me to, I think more broadly, we do need more comparative work. I think, as you know, with this book, I was very much closely involved with one particular case study, but there's, I think a comparative approach would have maybe shown me that this is not that unique to Bosnia. Maybe this is a much wider phenomenon, but I wasn't necessarily able to do that with the very close up, you know, field work that I was doing in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely plenty that remains to be researched. And I think in many ways, your book also provides us with a bit of a roadmap and a provocation in a good way of how such future research may be structured. Jesse, thank you for being my guest today on the New Books Network. I am very glad that we've had the opportunity to discuss this book. I encourage everyone to go and read it. And I would also like to say that given what you have produced with this book, I'm very much looking forward already to seeing how you deal with the topic of victimhood in a more historical context.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to discuss this with you. Thank you.
All right. That concludes this episode of the New Books Network. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and take care.